Rollo May once said, courage is not a virtue or value among other personal values like love or fidelity. It is the foundation that underlies and gives reality to all other virtues and personal values. Without courage, our love pales into mere dependency. Without courage, our fidelity becomes conformism. Welcome to episode 54 of Eyes Wide Open, where truthers of all stripes can further their personal journey of enlightenment. We publish a new episode every week on YouTube, Rumble, Spotify, and Twitter. I'm Lawrence Eastman, your host, and I'm here today for a second time with Evelyn Ray, where we get into the latest shenanigans on Prison Island, otherwise known as Australia. In part one, we discussed the rumours of mRNA vaccines in cattle, the Christian coronation of King Charles III, the return of the patriarchy, and Evelyn's interest in serial killers. In part two, we talk about how to regain food sovereignty, how to cut out the supermarket and connect directly with your farmer, and how to inspire the hearts of men to cultivate courage at home. But before we get into that, I just want to let you know you can see part two of this podcast and others by becoming a member of my site. It's just £5 a month, less than the price of a pint, and you'll be supporting independent content creators like myself to keep bringing you the truth. If you sign up today, you'll get a 7-day free trial. Link in the description below, or go to lawrenceeastman.com. But now it's time for our guest, Evelyn Ray, former police detective and now cattle rancher. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on a second time. It's always been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to getting into it again.
Cool. We start by trying to find out what you've been up to down under, you know, the other side of the world. If you're a globe believer or if you're a flat earther, it's just, you know, across the water. So how's it been in Australia? What's the latest?
Yeah, look, we've just been trucking on as we normally do, which, as I said before we started recording, is probably a little bit scary considering where we've come from. Our nation has just gone straight back to where it was prior to COVID. I've just been living my life. I've just been keeping to myself on my farm with my cattle and doing my own thing and just trying really hard to get as self-sufficient and as independent from everything else apart from myself in the interim. So that's pretty much all I've been doing, and just keeping an eye on things going on in the world and being cautious and wary of things that are presenting themselves.
So I think in part one, we'll talk about, politics in Australia, what we think's going on in the world right now. And in part two, I'd like to talk about solutions for people who are watching this and, you know, are interested in taking a more self-sufficient approach to their lives. And you're living the dream, as it were, as a cattle rancher. And we can talk upon that in a minute. I know we're kind of going through this period where everyone's gone back to normal, whatever that means, and they've totally forgotten about COVID like it never happened. And I'm guessing they want to pretend it never happened because, you know, a lot of people must be quite embarrassed about their behavior during that period. Now, I don't know what they've got in store, right? Whether they're plotting or planning another pandemic, I don't know. But we do hear a lot about this mRNA technology that underpinned the vaccines that were rolled out as part of the pandemic. And I'd never heard of that technology before. And since then, it's, you know, kind of been accepted as a given that that's the way modern medicine is going to roll out. And even Elon Musk, despite being critical of the way COVID was handled, has endorsed mRNA technology and says that it has all kinds of wonderful potential to cure many diseases. I don't know enough about it to even be able to question that statement. Now, I know we've been getting some news lately that for the people who refuse the vaccine, we're now being given this kind of narrative that there is no escape because we're going to start putting the mRNA in the food supply itself and you will be eating the vaccine. And we've heard stories coming from Australia that they're intending to put mRNA technology into the food supply, starting with the beef cattle. And as a beef rancher, I was hoping and expecting that you had done the research on this and you could share it with us and our audience, what your take is on that.
Yeah, so the mRNA, as we know, it kind of came out of nowhere during COVID, you know, like you mentioned. But now it seems like that is the way that they want us moving forward, not just for COVID, but for all vaccinations. So over here in Australia, for example, they are in the process of transitioning just our regular flu shot into mRNA technology. And they have spent millions of dollars building facilities in Australia purely to transition old vaccines into mRNA technology. So this is the trajectory we're on. And like you mentioned, the trajectory is also entering the food source. And interestingly, there's two separate mRNA vaccine with cattle rumors and happenings going on. So firstly, you also said mRNA has kind of only been around, since COVID. But with my research, something that I found and I discovered is that mRNA vaccines have been given to pigs since 2018. And this has been happening in America, in the States, for flu-like viruses for pigs. Now, this back in 2018 was done as a trial. And it was also accepted by veterinary schools over there. And it's sort of been happening since 2018, but it's really unclear where it has progressed since that time. If you look on the internet, it looks like it's still in trial phase. It's still not, you know, readily given to every single animal over there, but it's a long time ago, 2018, right? And they made the vaccines for us fairly quickly. So I'm a bit of a skeptic about it. You know, that was well before the pandemic. The mRNA was being given to pigs over there. So where is it now? I don't know. But in terms of Australia, we haven't and we don't have any mRNA vaccines available at all for any of our livestock, whether that be beef, pork, lamb, whatever, you know, meat. We don't have any mRNA vaccines, but there are two rumors going around. One, that they're going to be vaccinating all of the animals with mRNA vaccine so that the animal is immune to whatever virus, not COVID related, but whatever virus the mRNA vaccine is designed for, that is going to protect the animal. So they're transitioning vaccines for livestock, similarly to what they did with us, into mRNA technology. The other rumor is that they are going to be injecting dairy cows with mRNA vaccine so that when we consume dairy, we're having an ice cream down the road, we're going to be consuming mRNA technology. That's actually not an accurate description of what they're trying to do. So I did a little bit of research into it because there were rumors going around that 200 cattle in Australia have dropped dead after getting a mandatory vaccination for, you know, all kinds of things over here. Again, completely false. What the studies that they're doing at the moment, they're getting milk from bovine, which is, I think it's a 10 to 11 species of bovine, different types of cattle and things like that. They're getting the milk derived from the bovine and they're attaching, I forget how to pronounce it, it's X or something, it's some sort of protein from the bovine milk, and they're attaching COVID mRNA to that particular protein, and then we're going to then consume it as an oral vaccination to treat us for COVID-19. Now that again is something that they're doing in trial. They have successfully got it to get past in rats and things the gut, because what's difficult with mRNA is getting it through the gut lining, because that's when all these things break down. But they've successfully been able to graft the mRNA technology to the bovine milk, and then these animals, lab animals, have been able to consume the milk, and it's been able to get past the gut lining, and then the animals then accepted the mRNA vaccination that way. Again, we're not vaccinating cattle for it. The milk that's derived from the cow is from an unvaccinated cow. They're literally just taking milk from a cow to create an oral vaccine for us. And they're doing that under the guise or the veneer or the surface level covering of it's cheaper and easier to consume a milk drink than to inject people with a vaccine. So they're the two rumors. Again, no one's vaccinating any of the cattle for consumption. No one's vaccinating any of the animals for these diseases yet. Every single thing is in trial phase at the moment in Australia. We've just started a trial in the state of New South Wales in Australia on sheep, and they've injected sheep with mRNA vaccine for pestivirus, which is really common virus over here. 70% of all livestock have it and are naturally immune. But they are injecting sheep over here for a study. That they're in a biosecurity lab. They're not for breeding, for consumption, for sale. It's a very closed environment. But they want mRNA technology to be available by the end of this year, around August. So that's what they're pushing for. But again, I don't know how far in you want me to get with this, but it gets really complicated with our import and exports with our livestock. So it's not as black and white.
Okay. So I guess it's largely fear porn at this point in time then, because, you know, they may not be injecting cows with mRNA now as a way to get the vaccine into us. But I wouldn't be surprised if part of this narrative build that they're doing is to introduce us to the idea, assess the pushback, find out how many people are really bothered by it before they roll it out to the next phase. I mean, I wouldn't put it past them to do this as a way to, you know, get this so-called vaccine into the population. And they want everyone vaccinated, don't they? They don't just want, you know, the willing drones. They want even us, the dissidents, the people who are resisting it. And they're trying to find a way around that resistance. But I mean, it has to, if it is a vaccine and they're giving it through the food supply, there must be, you know, legal implications of that if you want to refuse. And then what are they going to say? Oh, stop eating food, you know, if that's how you want to beat this. But yeah, so do you think that this news story of the food supply being poisoned, like it isn't poisoned already, but this next level of poisoning of the food supply, do you think this is like a deliberate narrative push from those that are behind this, like Big Pharma? Or do you think this is just a rumor that's circulated and grown because of our natural skepticism to what we're seeing going on from the elites at the moment?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because it's really hard to decipher and wade through all of this information and figure out what's the truth of it. I think that's the most difficult part, because the skeptic in me, like you mentioned, I don't trust the government. I don't trust a single word that comes out of their mouth. I also am very aware of history, and history shows that the government can't be trusted, and that the government obviously, especially when they're not restrained by anything other than themselves, they are a tyrant. I don't trust what the government is saying, but at the same time, there is a lot of fear porn going on. And because of us not knowing what's real and what's not real, we're getting swept up in a lot of misinformation. It's happening on both sides of the political fence. And so trying to just be objective and impartial and unemotional to these things is a challenge. And as well as that, it's also helpful having discernment and looking at trajectories and going, sure, like this isn't here yet, but you can see where this is going. And so I think I'm in this stage where I know because I'm a farmer and I'm on the ground, this is what I do every single day. I know for a fact that there's no mRNA in any of our stock over here. Again, I don't think that there's any in other countries except for possibly pork. But again, I don't have enough information on that. But for what I know here, there is absolutely no cattle or anything being injected with mRNA. I know that as a matter of fact. It was only last week I just got qualified in doing pregnancy testing for all livestock animals. So sheep, goats, horses, cows, like I'm fully like, what are they called? Sonographers. I can put an ultrasound machine in an animal, in a beast, and I'm qualified to tell you if they're pregnant and all those things. So I just was around a lot of people from across all of Australia as well, all different states. And we were having lunch and I just sort of threw it out there in the room without looking like a massive conspiracy theorist. But it was like, have you heard anything in Tasmania about mRNA? Have you heard anything in Queensland? What about South Australia? What about Victoria? All the different states. What about the Northern Territory? And everyone looked at me like, what are you talking about? What are they doing with mRNA? Like, no one had any yeah. clue at all. And when I explained, well, we're actually in a trial phase in Australia. They're trialing mRNA. And then I posed the question, hypothetically, if the government said to you, you have to vaccinate your stock, what would you do? And they said, I'd tell them to go jump. And I said, really? I said, where were you 3 years ago when they said that they were going to do that to people? And these guys were like, oh. And I sort of stumped them a little bit there. These are old Aussie battlers. Like some of the people on this course with me were, in their 60s. Like they've been farming for a really long time. And bloodlines and breeding programs are very important to farmers, and they're freaked out when I mentioned mRNA. And it was sad. I was like, yes, good. Come on, farmers, stand up. But it was sad because I was like, why couldn't you have that much conviction about them doing this to human beings? You're worried about me bringing it up with your cows.
Yeah. But it's money, isn't it? It's affecting their livelihood then, but it's not just their own body. It's their livelihood. It's their stock.
Yeah, it's their short-term comforts. And that's what we saw. People were willing to sacrifice their long-term freedoms and the human rights for their short-term comforts and things that satisfied them in the moment. And that was the worst part, is so many of us were saying, you know, you might want to go to the pub with your friend now. And, you know, so you get the vaccine so you can go down and share a meal. But in 5 years' time, like, was that pub meal really worth it in the end? Like, you gave up a lot of things. And, you know, history again shows the government take far easier than they ever give back. Once the government have taken something from you, you can bet your left kidney that they're not going to give it back to you. So we were sort of saying the precedent, once it's set, is very important, and no one listened. I'm skeptical whether it will make much difference with the farming community. I feel like if they say you're not going to sell your beef or your lamb if you don't vaccinate, they probably will, to be honest. Let's be real. But, I know for sure there's no mRNA vaccines in anything over here. And I think that it could be likely in the future. But like I mentioned before, it's really deep when you go into imports and exports of meat from countries and through countries, because once you declare a country as having a disease, you can't sell or trade internationally. Right? So there are diseases that they want to mRNA vaccinate for that we don't actually have on our soil in Australia, like lumpy skin disease and foot and mouth disease. We haven't had that in Australia for over 100 years. So if we vaccinate our cattle for those things, that changes our import and export status, and we lose billions of dollars in our export trade for meat internationally. So I don't think we will do that. Because money speaks, right? And our nation would lose, and I don't see that happening. So it's interesting when you look at it from that perspective as well.
It depends upon what the motivations of those who are controlling events behind the scenes are. If it is to destroy our nations in order to soften us up for, you know, a takeover by somebody else, then, you know, I wouldn't put anything past them. But just for our listeners, including me, right, and I don't want to put you on the spot here. What is kind of like a working definition of what MNRA technology is, you know, for the layman?
That's a good question. I don't know. And that's the whole point of why I didn't take the thing. Because, you know,
it's experimental.
MRNA technology is, that's exactly right. It's experimental. And I don't know what the long-term effects of it, but from what I understand is it doesn't carry a live virus similarly to historical vaccines. So, you know, when we were growing up, we got vaccinated against the chickenpox virus, right? They would inject us with chickenpox so that it would stimulate an immune response, and then we would produce antibodies, which would then make us immune to that in the future. I think mRNA is somehow creates the spike proteins from these viruses and puts it on our DNA and creates that autoimmune response without the live virus. But again, that's, I don't know great details about it other than the major difference and what makes mRNA attractive to people with money is that there's they see it as a lesser risk because you're not carrying around vials of live viruses. So mRNA, for example, in livestock, they think that that's really good because it's safer vaccinating cattle, for example, for this when it's, you know, just an immune response or reaction for this virus as opposed to injecting the stock with the actual virus itself. But again, the whole point is there's no long-term data to assess whether this is safe technology or not. That's why I didn't take it. I'm not in that spectrum where I think every single human being who's had the vaccine is going to die in 5 years. Whether that's just me being naive, I don't know. I don't want to believe that to be true. And maybe I'm biased because I don't want to believe it's true because my parents took it and I love them. And I don't want to think about that. But I'm also, I'm realistic about it too. I don't think it's necessarily good and I don't think it's necessary, but I don't know if it's doom and gloom for every human being who's had it. I don't really know enough about it. And that's the whole point. And that's why I didn't take it. And that's why I won't take it. And I refuse to. And I'm going to dig my heels in now. I've decided for the rest of my life.
Yeah. No, good for you. I'm the same. Never will. And they'll never get me unless they pin me down. But and I don't want to will that. But it just seems to me, it sounds like black magic, basically, what they're doing. It doesn't seem like it's something that they want to reveal, which is they're keeping it hidden. They're making it a cult. I mean, what the hell is really going on here? And I don't think we're going to find out anytime soon. But it just... For me, this idea of poisoning the food supply so nobody can escape the black magic or whatever it is that they want to put inside us is just another example of the tyranny that we live under. We're given this false illusion that we somehow live in a representative democracy where the people's voice matters and we can vote in and out those people who either do a good job or do a bad job. And it's being exposed more and more now. It's not like I didn't already know, but you know, it's being confirmed on a daily basis that either democracy is designed to be like this, and that's the system we're living in, or the illusion we're being sold is exactly that, and behind it is the bare naked tyranny of monsters and demons who are running the show. Now, in the West, where I'm living in England, is now that's becoming more evident all the time with this shammed government that we live under. But we've recently just seen the coronation of King Charles III. My king and your king, right?
Yes, mine too.
yeah. So, and I thought it was a really interesting historical moment in this, you know, society and civilization we live under. He's obviously an unimpressive man. He doesn't strike you as a warrior king, as somebody who can defend his people, uphold the law. He just seems like someone who can be pushed around, basically, which is what I think a constitutional monarch is. Because if he was a proper monarch, no one would be pushing him around, would he? He'd be the baddest guy around.
That's right.
Yeah. And it kind of gave me like insight into how our system is run or should be run, because King Charles III was crowned by a priest. Now, we can argue about whether he's actually a priest or not, but ultimately he was crowned by a priest under God and made an oath to God and the people to uphold the natural law, God's law, and everything that flowed from the monarch, from the sovereign. And you know, as we now live in a constitutional monarchy, I think the disconnect between the power and responsibility of the king and actually the representative parliament below that seems to be quite distant, because parliament seems to be governed not by God anymore or God's law or natural law, but just by the whim of whoever is in power. And those people don't seem to be elected by the people, even though we think they are. They're elected by powerful financial interests who control the direction of the government. Now, I know you've got quite a lot to say on this because it ties in with your beliefs and your spiritual position, and also living in Australia. But what's your take on that, living in Australia? What kind of system do you think you're living under, and what system do you think would improve it?
Well, technically, we're a monarch, so we are under the king as well, but we're very much removed from the monarch. I think similarly to your own government over there. Mm. I think, you know, I watched the series The Crown, and I take that very much as fiction, and I take it, you know, very lightly. However, I thought they got something pretty accurate, which was the fact that the queen just kind of sits on her hands, right? And a lot of it is ceremonial, a lot of it is culture, a lot of it is just to, you know, have a certain appearance, but I don't think she necessarily had much to do with the laws of the land, so to speak. And I think that's very much the same over here. Our democracy or our government over here is very much a separate entity to the monarch, I believe. And we kind of run our own show here, but we're still attached to the monarch for sentimental reasons or who knows what at this point in time. You've got a lot of people in Australia who want us to become independent from the monarch, and you've got a lot of people who want us to remain attached to the monarch. I don't really know where I sit. I'd just rather just be left alone, to be honest. That's where I sit with all of this. But yeah, we sort of, like you mentioned, with his recent coronation, I tuned into that. One, because I'm Australian and I'm technically part of the monarch, and so I do enjoy that, right? And I love that culture, and I love the English culture. I'm proud of, you know, parts of it, not so proud of other parts. But I was like, I'm going to tune into this because this is, you know, I've only ever lived under a queen. This is the first king's
patriarchy
coronation,
so
I tuned in, and that's right, where it belongs on the throne. But I was, you know, I was really curious because I looked back at the Queen's coronation and I wanted to see what her speech was, and I wanted to see how she was sworn in and the oath that she took, because I was curious whether it was going to be upheld similarly with Charles as it was his mother. And interestingly, when the Queen was coronated, she did a similar thing where she took an oath and she swore to uphold God's laws, and she swore to spread the gospel, which is the Great Commission. As Christians, we are literally the Great Commission. The command is to go forth and disciple all nations. And that was part of the Queen's coronation. That was part of her oath. And so I always found it interesting when people said, especially to me, you can't involve God with your understanding of the civil government. And I'm like, hang on a minute, I'm part of the monarch. The queen is the head of the civil government as well as the church. And she literally took an oath that she, as the head of the monarch, would do and put God's laws forward with the Great Commission. So I was always like, well, why should you expect me to separate God from the government when the Queen literally took an oath to do that and I literally fall under her monarch? And so I wanted to see what Charles did, and he did it too. And I was like, wow, because I didn't think he would, knowing what he's been like in the past with his climate stuff and his woke globalist nonsense. I was actually thought, is he going to honour the tradition of it, or is he going to be one of the first to step out from that tradition and, you know, do a Harry and Meghan and and do something that is outrageous? And I was surprised, and I was actually encouraged by it, because I thought to myself, good, that gives us, the people under the monarch, more power to include God in the government, because he literally, our king literally swore to do that. So if people ever question why we should do that, we'll go, take it out with your king.
You are your own sovereign being with power beyond measure. But this knowledge has cruelly been hidden from you. They don't want you to know the truth, but I do. I've been pushing back against the tyranny of the increasingly totalitarian world we live in for a long time now. So with Sovereign Life Coaching, I can help you boost your business, overcome debilitating creative or personal challenges, and set you on the path to true health, wealth, and sovereignty. So let's work together to unlock your true potential. Find out more about Sovereign Life Coaching at the link below. Don't be someone else's subject. Be your own sovereign. Now, back to the action. But that's the thing, isn't it? Is that, you know, to give the monarch all that power, to transfer all of the sovereignty of the people to the king, it's a deal. You know, we're making a deal, a bargain with the monarch. We're saying, okay, we're happy to transfer our sovereignty on condition that you uphold the natural law, God's law, common law, whatever, you know, however we define that. But the law that protects the people from tyranny, that's the deal we're doing here. It's not like, okay, you're the king and you can do whatever you want. Mm. No, no, no. There is a very public declaration from the monarch that they will, in the eyes of God and the entire nation, uphold God's law, the common law, natural law, you know. And I think it was quite a powerful ceremony for people to witness that, you know, that's his job, and we can hold them to account. I know it's very difficult. I know it's very difficult to actually do that on a practical level, but it's there. The mechanisms are there, and we can do it through, like, me and you having this conversation now.
Yeah, and it, you know, courage is contagious, and things like that do give you a bit of courage and go, I'm on the right path here. Yes. Like, and so you do witness something like that. And I know for sure that King Charles is a pagan. He's not a Christian, right? Like, let's be real. You know, God says, you'll know them by their fruits. The man has rotten fruit. I'm not naive. I know he's not a Christian, but he has taken that oath. And that is a huge responsibility. And, you know, John Calvin once said, if God wants to judge a nation, he's going to give them bad leaders, right? And so you're looking at all the leaders, God knows who's in charge, right? He knows, and he puts people there for specific purposes, whether that's to bring judgment on us for completely turning our backs on him for so long, whether that's to bring us out of hard times. Like, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's certainly encouraging for me watching on as a Christian going, I'm glad they didn't drop that. We haven't lost that. That's still there. He might not be regenerate himself, but the foundation is there, and the justification for us speaking up about it is there. And on top of that, something that I found interesting as well is, did you notice all of the other religious people there paying homage to the Christian faith? There was someone from Islam that was there. There was a Jewish person there. There was a Catholic person there. They were all coming there to pay respect to Charles. And Charles literally swore an oath to Christ as being king, and he's going to honor that. And all these other religions came down and almost gave respect and gifts to him. And I was like, that's powerful, man, that like people are coming to the king of a monarch that acknowledges God and paying respect to that. I was like, that's powerful.
It's, you know, we talk about the failings of the man, right, of King Charles, or Charles, the failings of the man, but it's the office that we're really discussing. It's the office that the man occupies, right? Which is meant to be designed to elevate his failings, you know, so that he can act in good faith during the office. It's like, you know, police constables, the police get a really rough time at the moment, and deservedly sometimes they should get a rough time for it. But the office of constable itself is a very noble office. It should be a great honor to a man to take the oath of being a constable, because, you know, your job is to uphold the peace, the king's peace, God's peace. You know, that's a really potent honor to be bestowed upon a man or a woman, right? And it's the same, the king should also be regarded, or the office of king is a very noble, you know, it's the ultimate honor that can be bestowed upon a man, isn't it? Or a woman in the queen's case. But even though the man himself may have many, many failings, it was a great insight into this ancient institution. And like you say, it was quite a powerful and potent ceremony. Now, he's an old man. I'm not sure how long he's going to be around in that position, and William comes next. And we know that Charles has deep ties with the World Economic Forum, going back to the actual genesis of the project, which makes me kind of ask some questions of whether it's his project, you know, because he's in with his German buddies, his brethren. Klaus Schwab, is they were there from the very, very beginning. So I'm kind of speculating upon, he's got maybe 10 years, 15 years max as an active sovereign. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on whether he's going to be an activist king, or, you know, what's your take on his reign?
Yeah, I actually think he's just going to be quiet. I think if he was going to do anything, he would have done it during his coronation and would have made a bigger stand earlier on. I have the feeling that he wants to just sort of follow in his mother's footsteps. That's my take on it all. And it's interesting that the office itself is somewhat restraining him. Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of God's laws and God's natural laws as well, is a lot of people think if you remove God from things, you're going to be freer. Let's get rid of God and we can be free, free, free. But people don't realize when you release God, you unshackle the tyrant, because Christ is the only thing that shackles those things. And Christ right now has got King Charles in shackles. He does, because being in his position, he has to be somewhat impartial. He's not allowed to have public opinions of certain things, right? And so that was like me, like when I was a police officer and I took an oath, I wasn't allowed to commentate like this about political things. I had to be impartial. I was an officer who swore an oath to the Queen, and I had to fulfill her duty, and that was to shut my mouth and to do certain things. And thank goodness I'm not there anymore. I'm so glad I resigned. But Charles is kind of where I was, you know, like he's not allowed to speak. So his office is somewhat restraining him, and whether he continues to let it restrain him or not is the question. I actually have a lot of hope for Prince William's kids, Kate and Prince William's kids. I'm like, I wonder if he, is it George, the next one in line? Yeah. I think. I often wonder, is he going to be like the first Christian king? Because I'm really hopeful about our future, right? I actually think we're on, as hard as this is, I think what's going to come from this is new generations of people who are seeking Christendom, which is those natural laws, which is the old system, which is what saw the West flourish so successfully like it did in comparison to other nations around the world. I think we're headed back there because of these hard times. I'm not a pessimist that's like doom and gloom, Jesus is coming on the clouds. I don't think that at all. I think we're going to actually get into good times. We have to go through a bit, but I'm hopeful. I'm like, what if little Prince George, what if he's going to be like the first Christian king? Because by the time he's getting into that position, I think the world might be a bit of a better place, and Christ might be more widely accepted and acknowledged, and people might go, okay, we need him so that the world functions somewhat normal again. So I don't know what King Charles will do or William, but I'm hopeful that the tradition and the office lives on how it should, so that it allows and can make room for a little Christian king to come forth someday in the future.
Cool. Yeah, I remain hopeful too. I refuse to be blackpilled, and I think, you know, it's going to turn around. And I'm one of the signs, one of the signals, because I'm always looking for signals from the culture, was that Peter Tatchell, the pride activist, very dangerous man, and it's a sad indictment of our society that he even has a platform at all, came out and criticized King Charles III and William for not endorsing any LGBTQ, whatever they're called, charities. He said he's endorsed every other charities, but they've never done an LGBTQ. And I responded with, God save the king.
Right. But, yes, that's right.
Right. But it gave me a little bit of insight into that. And you know, we are now on the, oh God, it's actually Demon Month itself has just begun on the, you know, the same day that we're doing this podcast. And what we're seeing is Pride Month has begun. I'm not sure if we're going to see all of the corporations sporting a rainbow flag this year, because one thing I've noticed in the culture right now is that there is a definite pushback against this, I can only call it a demonic movement. It's not really about gay people or lesbian people anymore. It's gone way, way beyond that. It's now a clear and open demonic attack upon the children, because they see the children as the way to solidify this particular period in our history, is to make solid the base that they've tried to build upon with this Pride Month. And now with, you know, Bud Light almost being made bankrupt, and we're seeing things like the Mario film, which is a wholesome movie, and we're seeing more pushback now, and men being less afraid to speak out against this, you know, this evil acts against children, basically. And what's your feeling about where we're at culturally, using pride flag as the barometer?
Yeah, look, stupidity can only sustain itself for so long. And I think that it just got to that point where people have had enough. You know, they pushed. It was all under, you know, a costume of tolerance and acceptance and progress. But beneath the costume, people have been seeing what's under there for a long time, and it's taken others longer to get here. But I think we're here where it's like, okay, people have just had jack of it, and it was inevitable. It's like the snake eating its own tail. Eventually it's going to run out of tail and it's going to kill itself. And I think that's almost what this whole demonic agenda has done. It's eaten itself, because it's desperately tried to make people conform to the reality in their own heads, instead of objective reality. And, you know, it was encouraging seeing the Bud Light thing, and it was encouraging, like, wow, I think that is literally probably the first successful pushback that I have seen in my time of commentating. I mean, we've attempted it and failed miserably, but I think that that was probably one of the first successful ones where I'm like, we actually
I think it was a grave miscalculation, because, you know, they stupefy men by giving them sport and beer. That's the way that they can get rid of the men, right? But they made a miscalculation by going after the beer, going after the really cheap grog, you know, as you guys call it over there in Bud Light. And it was either it was a crazy miscalculation, or they don't control everything, or it was another, you know, testing ground to see how people would react. But they've reacted in a positive way, and we've seen it collapse. Same with Target. Target, who are putting in Pride tranny clothes for kids, is just seeing an immense pushback, whether it's a boycott or whether it's actual civil activism and going in and taking the clothes off the hangers and doing all kinds of interesting ideas to culture hack what's happening. It's all very, very positive from my perspective.
Yeah, it is positive, but part of me is one going, that is literally the power of the patriarchy,
yeah.
Right? I am all patriarchy. This is a patriarchal world. God created it as a patriarchal world. It is literally in his design. I'm all for that. And I went, right there, that's what men can do. Isn't it sad, though, that men got that upset about cheap beer? And I'm like, come on. Like, if you can do that, men, about cheap beer, imagine if all of you who boycotted Bud Light did it for other things that affected your children or your wives or women or the vulnerable, or like, right there is the power of the patriarchy. And let's just channel the power of the patriarchy to something maybe a little bit more beneficial than Bud Light. But was it a catalyst for change? Yeah. Maybe it was. Maybe that was, as I said before, courage is contagious. Yeah. Maybe Bud Light was a great segue into encouraging men how much power they actually have. Mm-hmm. I'm all for getting behind the patriarchy. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to be a woman who's trying to be at the front lines there. I want to get behind the patriarchy and help them on their mission. That's how God created us, right? God created man first, and he created all of creation. He didn't create women, right? He created creation. And he created man, and then he told Adam what to do, and he gave Adam a mission, and the mission was to steward the land, to have dominion, and to conquer, and to create the garden, to extend the garden, to name the animals, which has dominion over them, right? Once God gave Adam his mission, then he created Eve to help him on that mission, right? Men need to have a mission. Women should not be the mission. Men need to have a mission, and then women help men on that mission. So I'm like, come on, men. I will help you on this mission, but I don't want to be the mission. I don't want to be at the front lines. And I'm encouraged that this is how powerful men can be. Do it. Come on, blokes. Like, please, for all of our sakes, like, look how powerful you are. You can achieve so much more than us women screaming on the street. That's the reality of it, right? Yeah. Because us women can't even scream about sharing our bathrooms anymore with transgenders. We get shut down. We need men for this fight. And whether Bud Light was a segue to get men in this fight, I hope so, because I'm hoping it steamrolls and we keep going with the momentum, and it is encouraging.
Who said the perfect wife doesn't exist? Right, yeah. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it's, I think it's definitely going in the right direction. I think up till this point, I think a lot of it was due to fear because of the tyranny of the Pride movement, is that there were serious consequences if you spoke out. If you weren't a free agent, if you didn't have agency and you were still a wage slave, you know, you could definitely lose quite a lot if you spoke out against it. So there is definitely an element of fear, but also is like there is a serious loss of your position, status, even that if you spoke out. But that seems to be changing now. It seems to be the signals are coming from, I don't know whether they're coming from the state or whether they're coming from higher levels in the culture. The signals are saying, okay, look, it's safer for you to speak out a little bit now. I mean, even Twitter, regardless of what Musk is, what Musk does, is that we're being allowed to say these things on one of the major social media platforms. Once that's allowed, all of a sudden, like you say, courage is contagious. People can see other people saying it. They can see some of the threads now on Twitter where we see some of these demons saying these absolutely terrible things. Is that they are absolutely ratioed in their threads. They're getting hounded, right? And that is a new development in the culture war, because up to this point, if we did speak out like that, we would be piled on, we would be deleted from social media, your voice would be extinguished. But now there is a space in which we can speak out, and that's forcing people like Zuckerberg, if he doesn't want to lose all of his customers, he's got to push back a little bit in terms of the level of censorship. Otherwise, everyone will just bail over to Twitter. All good. Now we've just come to the end of part one. Before we finish, just want to talk about something that you mentioned on your Twitter, and it really made me laugh. And I thought, okay, I want to find out about this. Is that how does Evelyn Ray relax? And you said one of your favorite things is to research serial killers and solve cold cases. And I thought, whoa, that's a really interesting hobby. I haven't heard that one before. So I think for the benefit of our audience, tell us a little bit about Evelyn Ray's cold case solving skills.
Oh, look, it's probably not a healthy habit, so I don't recommend anyone at home trying this. But it's funny, I literally was a detective in the police, right? I one of the last cases I worked on before I resigned was a murder of an 8-month-old baby. And I did, so this is what I did, and I solved it, right? But I would come home and be like, oh, what am I going to do tonight? And I would put on American Crime because I would be like, I love how many more powers Americans have over Australians in terms of investigating crimes, right? In Australia, we start down here and the criminals up there, and the whole time we're trying to chase them, right? In America, it's like cowboy land. I love it. I'm like, I would rock over there as a detective with being able to use deceit and manipulation to get confessions, all these things. I'm like, wow, imagine that. I have to say please and thank you to these murderers. But no, I would, one of my favorite shows to watch was See No Evil. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but
no.
It basically solves crimes based purely off CCTV footage. So it's almost like dead crime. No one can solve it. And strike forces start and they collect CCTV footage from everywhere and they just trace cars for thousands of miles until they can get a facial image or a number plate, and they do all these sorts of things. And I would go down rabbit holes, and then I would watch documentaries on like the staircase killer. I don't know if you've seen that. All these sorts of things. And then I'd have my own theories and I'd sit there doing my own little research and go, oh, actually, I think this might be the killer. I think this might be. And I find it really interesting. It's this very sick, morbid side of me that might not be a good thing in 20 years' time.
how you know, cold cases then are cold cases when all leads have dried up and there's nothing else for the investigators to go upon, and therefore it's an unsolved case. Yeah. So is there, like, you know, why does that generally happen? And, you know, are there stories of those cases being picked up again by new investigators, new detectives, and then actually solving them?
Yeah, so it's rare, but it does happen. I witnessed it when I worked in the police a number of times. So sometimes what can happen is a case will go cold and then new evidence will come. So I got in a foot pursuit. I was doing an undercover sting in this really dodgy neighborhood, and there was a guy there that was part of a gang, and he was at the time doing things involved with minors as well as selling them drugs. And so I was undercover and I saw him do something, and that was enough evidence for me to arrest him. So I blew my cover and I got in a foot pursuit with this guy. I got him and I arrested him. When I arrested him, I took him back to the police station, seized his mobile phone. And when we went through his mobile phone, I've just put the serial number and details from in the mobile phone on the computer system. The next week, I got a phone call from the homicide investigation squad, and they said to me, can we please come and get the evidence from the phone that you got from this matter? We have a homicide that has links to that mobile phone. And I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being the guy that I arrested for dealing drugs to children and doing all the prostitution with children. He actually was the prime suspect of a murder. And the phone that I seized in a drug bust, pedophile bust thing was linked to this cold case murder that they couldn't solve from however long ago, and they could link it back. And then before it went to trial, this guy got murdered himself. So we never actually got a full guilty for it because he got murdered himself. But I have no doubt he was. But yeah, it was. And so that's how cold cases can work. Like, so years later, I did this thing and it was linked. It's just, so things like that can happen. As well as that, you can get people out of nowhere will want to call up and give you a tip off or something, or a victim of a crime, a historical crime, will finally have the courage and go, I'd like to make a statement about this. And then they'll come forth and give evidence. And then because they've given evidence, you're able to obtain DNA from that particular offender for that historical crime. And then boom, now that you've got this DNA from a historical thing, it's come up for 50 other rape cases.
Wow.
And from history. So it can just take one victim to finally get evidence, and then it can link it to 50 other crimes throughout history. And then you've got to go back through those cold cases and go through it. So it's fascinating how it works. You can, there's also public pleas, like the police will plea to the public and give rewards, like $1 million reward if people can tell me where Janice is. And then they'll have billboards with her photo and a phone number to call the police. And so a lot of people, you have to go through hundreds, obviously thousands of phone calls because people want $1 million. But part of the investigation is culling through that and going, what's real, what's not? Is there any new information, going through the old investigation? And so it's really fascinating. And again, it's the investigative techniques and tactics and the legislation is a lot more giving in like America, for example, than what you and I would have under our sort of legislations.
That might be a podcast in and of itself, talking about crime, investigating crime, police practice. I'd be sitting engrossed in that one. I really would, because you know, you're someone who's done it and you know, solved some pretty serious cases. More honour to you. Okay,
I will say this just quickly.
Yeah,
just quickly for people listening, there are certain things. Obviously, people hear that I was a police officer and automatically write me off and say, you know, all of these horrible things. I resigned for a reason, and I will just leave it at that. Mm-hmm. And don't call me a shill or any of those things, because I did leave for a reason. But that might be a good podcast, like you said, for another time.
I don't think you're anyone in this space unless you've been called a shill. So that's just a badge of honor, isn't
it? That's true.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's the end of part one. Thanks so much, Evelyn, for coming on. Before we do go, for those watching part one, where can our audience find you and what you're doing at the moment? Give us, you know, the lowdown on Evelyn Ray at the minute.
So yeah, find me on Twitter at the moment, underscore Evelyn Ray. You can find me at cauldronpool.com. That's cauldronpool.com. I write articles on there, and I also do my own podcast called The Cauldron Pool Show. First episode's dropping June the 12th. So that's season 2. If you're interested, yeah, you can find that on Apple, Spotify, Rumble, YouTube, all those sort of links too.
Great. Okay, so thanks for joining me for part one. Everyone who is watching this that are members, I'll see you over on part two in just a second.